We are going to call the Senate Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee to order, this interim committee to order, today, Wednesday, November 20th at 8, a little after 8. And we have a number of informational items today, and I'm really thankful for all the people that come here and willing to talk to us and explain the different issues that are going on. So with that, we're going to open up an informational meeting on Economic and Community Development Aligned Project, House Bill 2620. So we'll open that informational meeting, and Michael Jordan and Matt Garrett, come on up, who are part of the committee, that group. And thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and specific to House Bill 2620, I have the privilege of chairing a project steering committee that has been assembled from diverse folks, but working with the Chief Informational Officer, Mr. Jordan, here. So I'll open up the conversation where we began, kind of giving a very brief overview of what the charges were that were embedded in House Bill 2620, and then take us up to a point where we are, I would say, aggressively engaging at a very fast pace, because we do need to come back to you and your colleagues in February 14 to deliver a plan. So with that, the House Bill 2620 actually had four salient points. The first, it directs that a plan can be developed to better align and integrate state economic and community development programs with regional and community-based development programs. So again, taking the independent efforts that are underway in the investment streams, the various policies and practices, and try to tighten them up. I think it's an underpinning. Second charge is this plan is to be submitted and for consideration during the 2014 legislative session. The third significant component is an engagement of the regional solutions team, the centers, the local governments, as well as the private sector, again, to work in an effort to better integrate the community and economic development practices, protocols, programs, as well as investment priorities here. And the fourth and final directs the natural resource agencies to participate with the regional solutions teams and the regional solutions centers in this conversation. So, as I said before, Mr. Chairman, we have assembled a quite diverse project steering committee to oversee these activities. Again, the pace is very aggressive. We are moving quickly. But what we have sitting around this steering committee table are probably very close to a dozen state agency directors that have some fingerprint on the outcome area of economic and community development. We have the regional solutions staff representative there to ensure that we have the threads that bind the charge embedded in the bill with this effort. And then finally, we have, we have private sector representatives, those folks, those boots on the ground working with local economic development opportunities to share their insights to bring down that lens. And then finally, we have advocacy groups, Thousand Friends of Oregon, the League of Women Voters. Again, they have participated in this conversation from the beginning. They sit around the table and continue to form as we move to implement and animate this plan. I think to date, the foundation of our work really resides in aligning these development programs, looking across agencies in a panoramic view, rather than the siloed approach that budgets are built on. We're now looking at a panoramic view, a cross cut between agencies, seeing exactly where various policies and investment streams are flowing in order to make an impact at the local level, because that is exactly what we want to do, support the local priorities that have been developed by the Regional Solutions Committee structure. We believe this is foundational to the extent that there has been significant vetting of the issues, and those priorities through the regional solutions have risen up, and they've been identified across the 11 regional sites across this state on what's important, be it streamlining type efforts, the developable land issues, land use type issues, workforce issues, housing issues. All those have risen to the tops, and we believe that provides the foundation to jump off and shoot to align and integrate our policies here. So we've taken that information, but we've also been extremely aggressive in terms of outreach. We want to make sure that all voices are heard in this conversation, and we've secured that as we move to animate this plan. So we have cast a survey far and wide. To date, I believe we've had over 2,000 responses coming back to the survey asking these questions. What's the best way to address the issues of alignment, to focus on better coordination, reduce fragmentation, help eliminate redundancy, and just put a better product down on the ground to meet those local priorities? I think with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hand off to Mr. Jordan, and he can continue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the state's chief operating officer and the director of the Department of Administrative Services. And we are staffing and supporting Director Garrett and the steering committee in the process. I'd like to go into just a little more detail about the steps we're using. First of all, I want to tongue-in-cheek thank the legislature for annual sessions. In a normal world, we would have had 18 months to do this work. We have six now, or seven, and we're moving at what is light speed for us to try and bring a plan to the 14th session. So as Matt mentioned, we began this process after the adjournment of the last session with a data gathering process, gathered data from the field, as he mentioned, but also gathered data from all of the regional solutions committees to make sure we understood what we were trying to align to. And as you can imagine, as Matt also mentioned, it's a cross-cutting approach to this policy area, which exists in multiple agencies. We have over 100 programs across multiple agencies that are delivered to local communities for economic and community development purposes. We decided at the steering committee level that how we should align the work would be to take those multiple project lists and plans that have come from the regions and categorize them by kind of operational category. So infrastructure and land availability was a common theme across multiple regions. Another issue that we were looking at, certainly across all of the different areas, was different regulatory processes that we needed to be aware of. And then the other major category of work in the plans were business services, recruitment, retention, what kinds of services can be supplied to businesses for both starting and expansion. And so we've taken the programs and I'll try to orient them to those priorities which exist in the regions. And then we took all of that data, both the input through the survey work and the input from the different plans, aligned those, and we attempted to build scenarios in the second phase of what were the things we could actually do that would be helpful. And as an example, we're still in process for that. We had a major kind of big summit last week bringing both program managers and the people in the field in local communities who experience those programs, practitioners, if you will, that are trying to do community economic development in the field, brought them together to sit and to examine those programs and start to produce some scenarios of change, if you will, about how we could do better in those categories that I mentioned, infrastructure, land, business services, and regulatory reform issues. One example of that was that there was an idea that we probably ought to be able to take all of the funding programs that we have regarding infrastructure and be able to administer them in a much more coordinated way. In other words, when we're trying to perhaps get a site ready for development, we have numerous funding programs that can be applied to that site for different issues. We don't often sequence those fundings in a very strategic way for folks who are receiving those programs so that we can be much more rational in the way we approach a particular site. or group of sites in a community. So there are ideas like that that are coming out, which really will inform the way we approach bringing a plan to you about implementing change. We're going to take those scenarios now back into the field. We're, as Matt mentioned, we're going to hold a number of workshops across the state in the month of December. We will be on the road, both giving information to folks at these workshops and also receiving their input, testing, if you will, these ideas against the input that we get from folks. We're using the networks for those regional solutions committees on the ground to actually make sure the word is out for these. We received almost 2,000 different responses from our survey from both practitioners and people that are associated with regional solutions committees, a really high percentage, and I can't remember, but I want to say like 80% of those folks said they'd be interested in these meetings. Now, saying you're interested on a survey and actually showing up are two different things, but we're expecting pretty high turnouts at these, and we're hoping for a really energetic exchange. We'll use those to inform those scenarios, that input, and hone those during the month of December and January to bring you recommendations. I want to emphasize that this is going to be a 1.0, 2.0, 3.0 kind of journey that we go on. We're not going to boil the ocean in February of 14. We have a long way to go on thinking about how we can coordinate and change our business plan, if you will, in such a way that we're more effective on the ground in communities. It is, as I mentioned, over 100 programs, some of them fairly regulatory, some of them almost entirely capital-oriented, and some of the mixes in between. And then the last thing I want to mention before I'll stop is, as something Matt mentioned, in the bill itself, there is a clause in the bill about getting natural resource agencies more engaged at the regional solutions tables. I'm convening a separate group of the natural resource agency folks to start to work out how are we actually going to make that real on the ground. It's one thing to say it in words in a bill. It's another thing to actually have warm bodies that can be at meetings, that can actually hear what's going on in communities, and then have the ability to actually streamline our processes, bring more resources to bear on a particular issue in a community. When we've been able to do that, we know we've been successful. When we haven't been able to do that, we get sometimes mired a bit in our own processes and can get in our own way on occasion. So I think our goal in all of this, A, is to bring you what can we do right away in the 1.0 version in 14, but also foreshadow for you some of the things we can continue to do and potentially bring back in the form of a proposed budget in 15 and some policy changes that can take us to the 2.0 version and start to foreshadow that in February. So that's kind of in a nutshell where we are right now, and you may have some questions that we can respond to, or I didn't. Matt, you may have anything else.
Any questions?
No.
I just have a comment, because when I was on the water board in Coos Bay, ODOT turned out to be a really good partner, because they would be coming in to resurface a road or do a section of road, and they started giving, and I don't know who started what, but they started giving a lot of advanced warning to the water board, because our water lines right-of-ways were oftentimes in the same place. Mm-hmm. And what was the worst thing was we'd have a plan that says we're going to replace this pipe, and it was 2 months after they just finished the road. And so then we dig up the road that was brand new and put a water line in it.
Leaves a good impression.
People got really upset. Community members thought that was really stupid, which we had to agree. It was pretty stupid. And so all of a sudden we started getting a lot more. We had a plan about what we were going to do, and we changed the plan to meet the stuff that was happening over here. And so they say, oh, here they're coming in 6 months. They're going to do this. We need to move this portion of the section. And with timelines, our committee, you know, our water board had time to have a meeting and say we're rearranging our priorities to do this. And if we don't coordinate it, it was horrible. And, you know, the one that was really sad was the private industry. When we got gas in, I mean, they didn't have a choice when the gas was coming, and they did a lot of the stuff underground, so we didn't have to worry. But every once in a while, there were cuts right in new roads and whatever. They didn't have a choice. I mean, that was the way it is. And I'm hopeful that this communication, including private and everybody, will lead to more of that kind of coordination.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, since you spoke about ODOT, I think that really captures the essence of trying to get out in front and bringing all the resources together at the first hour, not the 11th hour,
right,
to facilitate those kind of conversations. I think it is incumbent upon the state to be a facilitator, to bring that resource, and I think this effort certainly underpins that. I think the reality is what you're seeing is you're seeing an organizational shift, but at the same time you're seeing an attitudinal shift to get out in front of things. So we're not impacting and inconveniencing the public over and over again. I think people, if you talk to people, understand, get it done. You've got an asset to take care of or improve, but get in and get out and do it once here. Just make sure we're coordinating here. So I think, as Mr. Jordan said, this will be iterative and evolutionary, but it will be transformational to the extent that I think we will get to a point where we are indeed aligning our various programs, the finances, as well as our human resources as well. It's that capacity. And then to some of the natural resources and some of those agencies that hybrid, that have, and ODOT being one of them, that have not only an infrastructure capital investment protocol, but also have a regulatory protocol. I think looking for opportunities without lowering the bar, one iota, but looking for opportunities to expedite project review for those priorities here. And again, it's going to make conversations more focused, and the obligation is to have the courage to prioritize investments here. Because again, finances aren't going to be any easier. They are going to be a challenge. So with the monies that we do have, let's make sure we're investing them in those priorities that have been well vetted, and understand that those are tough decisions. So simple in concept, implementation is always a challenge.
Yes,
Senator Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jordan, you talked a little bit about talking about different regulatory processes, and you, Mr. Garrett, you talked about existing businesses that you're looking at helping. Have you discussed federal regulations and how they affect our businesses? And have you talked about what type of power you might have as state agencies to try to steer federal regulations so that they don't impact our industries in this recession time with more and more costs that they have to absorb, and then they can't make a profit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Close, the short answer is yes. It's a discussion, and as I said before, I think our experience is when we are most successful is when we can bring the resources to bear, not just from state agencies, but also from our federal partners, onto particular problems. We have been successful with the Corps of Engineers. We've been successful with U.S. Fish and Wildlife when we've been able to get people together and start to problem solve on a particular issue in a particular community. That's when we've been most successful. If we can start to translate that experience in kind of the way we run programs, and as Matt mentioned, and he's mentioned it until I'm sick of hearing it, this is an attitudinal shift as much as it is about the way we run our programs. And we have to convene our federal partners as much as we can to do that. And you're very well aware, I know, that there are some cases where we actually act for the federal partner in our regulatory role. And so we have a natural way to engage them in these things. We just have to take that opportunity much more aggressively than we have and more regularly than we have in the past.
Thank you.
Other questions?
No.
I want to thank you. I mean, my feeling, having since getting into the legislature, is that we are going at a faster and faster pace.
Yes,
I think annual
indeed.
Sessions have helped that a lot. But at the same time, it is important that we know the little steps that are going in between, because we pass a bill, and then the next session it shows up as recommendations,
right.
And in between there wasn't any discussion with most of the people. Some people heard, but not most. And so you got to go over the whole thing repeatedly. And I'm thinking that these interim committees, from my perspective, this has become a more and more important part of getting that information out ahead of time so it isn't a surprise when it shows up.
Absolutely.
Because half the time we forget that we passed the bill, and now we've got, you guys don't because you were interested to do something, but they didn't necessarily match. So thank you for taking the time today.
It's our pleasure. Really,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yep.
So we're going to close the informational meeting on economic and community development alignment of House Bill 2620. And we're going to go a little bit out of order because we have an esteemed senator here with us. So we're going to move to redevelopment of the Umatilla Chemical Depot. So I will open an informational meeting on that. And Senator Hansel, come on up, and you can bring whoever you want and whenever you want them to come on up. And we know this has an impact in your area.
Chair Roman, committee members, for the record, Senator Bill Hansel from District 29, which the Umatilla Army Depot has, is wholly within the framework of the district. I thought it might be helpful if I gave you a little bit of a personal background as to my involvement in the Army Depot base. In 1988, as a Umatilla County Commissioner, I began to be involved and was actively involved in the issue there as a county commissioner until I resigned last December 31st to get ready to take the new office that I had been elected to. In 1988, the federal government established what they would eventually become known as the BRAC program. They began base realignment and closure. And of the, I believe there were six bases across the United States in BRAC 1 that, or maybe up to nine, I guess, that had been slated for closure. And the Umatilla Army Depot was one of them. So they passed this bill, Congress did. Then Governor Goldschmidt said, well, what do we do? We better form, and working with his then Economic Development Director, Bob Buchanan, who was from Umatilla County and a good personal friend, we've got to do something. They're going to be closing the base. So the governor formed a task force. It was a gubernatorial task force, and I was privileged to be asked to join it. And we began to work on some type of plan. We had no federal guidelines whatsoever. Bob, working with then Congressman Lessa Coyne, got an earmark, an appropriation to put together a plan, finance a plan. We originally turned it down because we said, as long as we've got 11% of the nation's chemical weapons, we're not closing anything until that gets taken care of. So there's no reason to start making a plan at this time. But Bob came and spoke to us and said, you know, state's going to have egg on our face if we don't do this, because Representative Coyne worked very hard to get this for us. So we hired Benkendorf and Associates, and we put together the first plan for the reuse of the base. Well, what was happening nationally is, because there were no federal guidelines, it was a real hodgepodge of who you deal with, and some bases, unlike ours, which has two jurisdictions, about 40% is in Umatilla County and about 60% in Morrill County, so you had two jurisdictions. Some of them in metro areas had a dozen, 12, 15 different pieces of cities and counties and states and, you know, a whole bunch of things. So under President Clinton and Senator Pryor from Arkansas, who had Pine Bluff in his district, which was another chemical weaponry storage area, they put together a legislation of how the federal government was going to deal with local jurisdictions. It was basically called the LRA, the Local Reuse Authority. So we morphed from a governor's appointed task force to a federally recognized LRA. And we put together five jurisdictions locally. The two ports, Port of Umatilla, Port of Morrill, the two counties, Morrill County and Umatilla County, and from the very beginning, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And we had this LRA governing body. And so we began to work on different opportunities that were out there. There's a rail yard, which you'll learn more about now. We were beginning to work on that. Part of the challenge we had is that every 2 years, the Army replaced the commander of the post. So, you know, different ones would come in, and we were working. We had to work with the Pentagon. We were really moving forward really well until something happened on 9/11. And that just shut everything down. And with those rockets out there, the chemical weaponry, all the plans, all the different things were just put on hold. And the base just basically went into a shutdown mode until the weapons were destroyed. So that was kind of a disappointment, but we certainly understood. Then, to our surprise, in 2005, when the BRAC stuff came out again, every so often it came out, we're not on the list anymore. We were in BRAC 1. We've kind of been delisted. And now we're not even in the, or I guess it was about 2005, 2004, somewhere in there. So what's going on now? And they had decided that because the projection was clear out to 2020 for destruction, 2015, something in there, there was no reason to keep us in the loop. So we had a whole new battle to fight. Eventually, they saw that that timeline was not correct, that the incineration was going to take place. It ended up doing it, and it went almost flawless, no problems whatever to speak of, and it's all gone now. But we then had to reconstitute our membership, and we added the state this time. We kept the five original members, but we added the state of Oregon to the mix, and that included two representatives. One from the military, the Oregon National Guard, because they were very much interested in the base. And the other one was from the Oregon Solutions team, the local representative, Scott Fairley. I had the privilege around 2009 when we were getting underway with the implementing local reuse authority. I served as chair. I served in that capacity up until I resigned from a county commissioner. So I was one of the original two members that are still on it. We're still on it 18 some years later. And so I saw the whole gamut. I share that with you to give you a little bit of personal history here. Because through the years, as a local leader, I was very much invested in it, attended numerous meetings. I'm happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time. But this is very, very key to our part of the state to be able to take that asset and move forward with it. And I appreciate the opportunity to kind of share a little bit of my personal involvement and look forward to working with whatever we can do to make this a real asset for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who wants to go next?
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Don Chance. I'm the project manager for the LRA. And as the senators just mentioned, the LRA is made up of two counties, two port districts, and the Confederated Tribe of the Umatilla. It's an organization that's recognized by the Department of Defense, specifically charged with the preparation of a redevelopment plan. Once that plan was completed in 2009-2010, the Army has basically adopted that plan. The Army will utilize and is utilizing that plan as basically their blueprint for the closure of the base and how these lands will be used in the future. In fact, they're obligated by law to utilize a redevelopment plan. They're not obligated to follow our recommendations in terms of how those acres will actually be then transferred off. The Army has probably a dozen different mechanisms by which they can transfer the acreage. They can go to public sale. They can transfer acres to other federal agencies. They can transfer acres to state agencies. They can give conservation grants to land trusts in the area. They can do what's called an economic development conveyance, which is what the local community is interested in pursuing. But I'll go through that here in a moment. Just a real brief history of where we stand on the base. The base is 17,000 acres in size. It's basically split down the middle between the two counties. The county line runs right through the middle of it. It was created in 1940. There are literally 1,001 igloos, bunkers, on it, evenly spaced across the 17,000 acres that were the storage bunkers for munitions and other military supplies. These bunkers are 2 feet thick of reinforced concrete and then several feet of compacted soil on top. They're very expensive to remove. They're $30,000 a piece for demolition. So at 1,001 bunkers, we're basically learning to live with them because they're not going to come down. The base provided munitions and other military supplies in World War II and virtually every other military action the country's been involved with since World War II until very recent times. It's historically employed somewhere between 800 and 1,500 people. The most recent employment surge there centered around the construction of a $700 million incinerator plant and then the operation of that plant. The base is closed last year, 2012, officially, and total employment there now is down to about 130 people. So the community has felt the impact of the base closure. Those 130 individuals are pretty much, they're all contractors involved with the decommissioning of the incinerator. Unfortunately, we fought hard over the last couple of years to try to retain the incinerator. It was the best piece of infrastructure on the base, the most recent, and a very high-tech facility. It could have served as a regional incinerator for hospital waste, probably serving a radius of 200 miles. But because of liability issues and concerns, the internal core of the incinerator has now been demolished. It's come down in the last 3 months and been hauled off to the Arlington hazardous waste site, so it no longer exists as a facility. There were never any chemical spills on the base. And there's, I think, some misconceptions about how the base was used. The chemical weapons on the base, there was a transitional time period. Chemical weapons weren't put on the base until about 1962, I believe, and they were always stored in one small portion of the bunker complex. Most of the igloos never had any chemical weapons in them. The chemical weapons weren't in, you know, as you might imagine, containers. This stuff was actually attached to the munitions, so it was part of warheads, and which complicated, of course, the incineration process and handling of it. There were never any chemical spills. Everything has been checked and rechecked and re-rechecked so that the base is completely clean in that context, but it does carry a stigma associated with it because of the materials that were there. Most of the infrastructure on the base is very old. Most of it was created in the 40s, so the buildings, the roadways, the utilities are at their far end of their useful life at this point, which is an issue for the Redevelopment Authority because we're looking at some significant investments to be able to reuse this land in a productive way. So where we are today, the Department of Defense process for base closures is very complex. You have to jump through quite a few hoops to go through this process. We started it again in 2009. It's been a very active process since 2009, and we're still in the final throes of completing the studies that are necessary for that. Overlaid on the Department of Defense procedures, we've had the complication of compliance with the Oregon land use system. You can imagine we've got a unique situation here. 17,000 acres that were never zoned, that were never incorporated in either the county comprehensive plans because as federal ownership, they were always exempt. So this is a parcel that is centrally located in the county. It does cause transportation connection problems for the county because it's a big block of acreage in the middle of the county where road access can't be permitted from one jurisdiction across it. So where we're at on this is that we're having to go through up the process of, and it's been interesting. No one's really known how to handle it in the LCDC kind of context. What do you do with 17,000 acres? It basically is has the characteristics of an industrial complex in terms of how it's been built out and the uses that are there, but it's far beyond any of the urban growth boundaries and sits at the intersection of two interstates. It has economic development potential, but we're beyond urban growth boundaries. So both counties are having to go through an exceptions process to modify their comprehensive plans and bring zoning to it for the first time. So between the Department of Defense requirements and state requirements, we're working our way through that. It's one of the things that's complicated. We're dealing with a lot of actors, two counties, two port districts, the Confederated Tribes, the interests of the Oregon National Guard, the Red Cross. We have a dozen entities out there that have some sort of interest in the base redevelopment. So it's been a crowded dance floor as we sort of work out the chemistry of who's going to get what and how this is going to all work in the transfer. To date, we've spent about $2.5 million in the required studies and plans to get to where we are, a lot of money. The local governments and entities, and all the funding for this has come either from federal grants or from the local entities. We currently have two major studies ongoing, and for the first time, we've gotten some state support. Thanks to the efforts of Senator Hansel here, we're having to do an IAMP study for three of the interchanges. That's a $400,000 exercise, planning exercise, and we've been able to ascertain or obtain a $40,000 in state match monies to match this $400,000 study that's ongoing currently. So we're close. The current timing is that we expect by the end of 2014 to be in the final negotiations with the Army about the potential transfer. We're asking for a no-cost transfer. That's unusual. They would normally negotiate a package with profit sharing in the future or actual payment, but the liabilities are so great out there in comparison to the asset values that the Army has you know, in our current conversations, they said, we recognize you're facing some serious hurdles here, so we're going to entertain your no-cost proposal. But it's something we still have to work out with them. We don't expect the land transfers to happen until about early 2015 or mid-2015. At that point, the acreages involved with the LRA will come to the LRA, and then we will probably disperse them quickly to the two port districts or a combination of the port districts and the counties. And one of the quirks in the federal system is that any revenues that come off of these, off the economic development of these areas, the proceeds from that have to be plowed back into infrastructure improvements on the base for a seven-year time period. The jurisdictions can't use that for anything other than base infrastructure. So with that, I'd like to just quickly show you where we are on the land use plan. 15,000 acres, about 7,500 acres of it is going to the Oregon Military Department. The Guard, as you were here shortly, is creating a major training base. They have used it historically in the past. It's an important facility for them. That's helpful for us. The I-82 swings this direction, I-84 comes that way. So the base, we have an intersection right down here of the two interstates. The base's basic value is its transportation assets. There are only five locations in the state of Oregon where you've got an intersection of two interstates. There's only one of those locations on the east side and where land is relatively cheap and congestion isn't an issue. So this intersection down here has high value from a business logistics, shipping, transport, warehousing kind of capacity, which all of our studies indicate is probably how we'll end up using we're hoping this area down here. The other thing that we have going for us is that we have the base is well served by ample and inexpensive power. Some of the characteristics on the base are highly attractive for data storage centers. They like secure bases, secure locations, ample and multiple power sources. We have a lot of natural gas lines in the area, as well as cheap electric power. And they like cool High Plains desert environments without any natural hazards. We meet all those criteria, so it's an attractive. We're already being contacted in that capacity by those kinds of companies now.
Of the 15,000 acres, there's a large component of it that's designated to go to a new wildlife refuge. And initially, we thought it was going to be taken by the fishing game at the federal level. They backed out of that arrangement, so we're now shopping for a future ownership manager, and it will probably be the local land trust that will do it. But we need to generate a revenue source for them for annual operations and maintenance of that. And we've got some creative ideas that we're working on to have. Of the 15,000, about 3,000 acres are slated for industrial development. This corner down here, we have really very strong rail access. It's the major rail line coming through. This industrial 200 acre this is the incinerator site. And it has the best infrastructure on the base currently, lots of power, its own power substation, and some buildings that will be left over. So it does have value, which is why this piece is sitting up here like that. And then, of course, this L-shaped component down here that wraps around. So 17,000 acres, major chunk is going to the Oregon National Guard. That transfer should happen here pretty quickly. You'll hear about that here in a moment. But that's kind of how the total 17,000 acres has been allocated.
Don, you might point out for him, too, we have another transportation with the Union Pacific Main Line.
The Union Pacific Main Line runs here. It's kind of a critical component, too, because one of their large transfer facilities is located up in Hermiston. So we're sitting on top of a major rail capacity kind of capability. The problem we have is that among many in terms of infrastructure is Union Pacific, some number of years ago, pulled two switches out of here. Those switches are $2 million apiece. And for us to be able to utilize this capacity in here, we're going to have to go reinvest back in the tune of $3 to $4 million to reestablish those switches to have that rail capacity be of use to us.
Can you tell us why they pulled them?
There was a bit of a dispute. There was they had a rail storage yard here, and they weren't being particularly careful about spills. The Army got on their backs about it, frankly, and said, hey, we can't permit this to happen any longer. And they sort of said, well, we're going to take our tool and go home. And these switches are of high value to them, so they yanked them. But so we will know later in the year. We're conducting a detailed study currently, but we're probably facing infrastructure investments in the neighborhood of about somewhere between $20 to $40 million to bring this ground up to speed. That's a big hurdle for the local community. And normally I would say we're not going to be able to get there. But our port districts, particularly the Port of Morrow, I don't know how familiar you might be with them, but it's a very successful operation. And the individual who runs it has run it for the last 20 years has really been quite successful. They've generated 6,000 jobs. They have over 50 manufacturing plants. In the downturn, they didn't have any retraction among the employers there. They have two new manufacturing facilities going up in the neighborhood of $300 to $400 million investments apiece. And so we have the capacity out there to make these things happen. Mostly because of the experience of the people involved.
Where is Port of Morrow in respect to that?
It's 6 miles this way.
Okay.
This large chunk of industrial ground here is slated to go to the Port of Morrow.
Yep.
And these components here will either go to the Port of Umatilla or to Umatilla County.
And Chair Roblin, Senator Przanski, remember I told you that every 2 years you had a different commander? Well, we got a commander that decided he would take on the Union Pacific, and, you know, we just had to sit, work it out. But didn't work it out, and that whole asset is just sitting there now.
Yes, Chair, please. Members of the committee, record, I'm Colonel Christian Reese, Director of Installations for the Oregon Military Department. The Oregon National Guard had an enclave there at Umatilla since the 1980s, and when it became apparent that it was slated for closure, we worked with the congressional delegations to help solidify language that would enable us to be part of this LRA process and move this towards from a chemical mission, storage mission, to training for National Guard soldiers here in Oregon and within the region. The Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2012, containing the National Defense Authorization Act, included language inserted through the efforts of Senator Wyden in Oregon's congressional delegation that stated the Secretary of the Army may retain minimum essential ranges, facilities, and training areas at the Umatilla Chemical Depot, totaling approximately 7,500 acres, as a training enclave for the reserve component of the armed forces to permit the conduct of individual and annual training. So with that insertion, that sort of helped lay the groundwork for what you see on the map there, which for the area designated for military. So that's roughly 7,500 acres. It's from our perspective, it's actually part of a larger regional training strategy that involves both the Umatilla Depot and then 12 miles down the road is the Boardman Naval Bombing Range area. So we saw those two as sort of one idea for the Oregon National Guard, where we would have the cantonment area here for the billing of troops, the dining facilities, ammunition storage, small arms ranges, some maneuver space, and then down the road at Boardman there would be some larger machine gun, larger caliber type ranges that would serve as one idea for training. And so we've worked with the LRA for many years here to try to make this come to fruition. There were some slides that we brought along, but I'm not sure if they've made it to the members of the committee. So I'll talk more generally about where we are in the process. As we work through the LRA process, obviously there are many components on the Army side that we have to deal with. The BRAC office is the main entity with it handling the property for the Department of Defense, and they have a BRAC transition coordinator that works out there on the property, and we work through their office, and the other entity that's part of this from the DOT perspective is our federal component for the National Guard, which is the National Guard Bureau in Washington, D.C. So trying to coordinate between the Army trying to dispose of this through the BRAC office and the National Guard acquiring this through a federal license really involves those two entities and the Oregon National Guard. And I was just in Washington, D.C. the last 2 days meeting with both of those agencies, and everyone seems to be speaking the same language, and we are very close, we believe. The last sort of piece of the pie for us is sort of this an environmental MOU, a memorandum of understanding between those three stakeholders, if you will. The National Guard Bureau had some concerns about other sites that they picked up around the nation that have resulted in larger environmental bills than they had anticipated. So they've been very conservative in their approach to this facility, wanting to make sure that that everything is taken care of and that future environmental roles and responsibilities are well established. So I think once we get through this last legal piece, which we anticipate to take 90 to 120 days, and then get the signatures necessary from each of those agencies, that we would expect our property transfer to be completed sometime in the May-June timeframe of 2014. So that's where we are currently. I wanted to talk a little bit about how we're using. Right now, we are helping to manage. There's a caretaker contract right now on the site that has approximately 24 full-time employment plus security staff of additional 10, and we're helping to manage that contract for the BRAC office out there on the site. Our regional training institute has relocated to Umatilla in the cantonment area there, and this is the National Guard's sort of professional schoolhouse, where we train soldiers to give them certain professional accreditation in certain fields. In Oregon, we have 11 Bravo, which is the infantry MOS, military occupational specialty for some of our soldiers. We train that at Umatilla, and so that schoolhouse has now been established out there, and we hope to continue to grow the number of courses that they do into the future. We'll also have our monthly unit training assemblies out there, the drill weekends for soldiers. We'll have a field maintenance shop. We'll have a storage site for the training equipment that's used. The predominant unit that's along the I-84 corridor is a third of the 116 Armored Battalion. And they have a combination of tanks and Bradleys, armored vehicles that will be stored out there. That primarily will be used for gunnery over at Idaho at the training, the gunnery ranges at Gowan Field. But they will continue to use this site also for some of the tasks they can do here in Oregon. In addition, there are other entities. This is also seen as a potential FEMA Region 10 asset as well, the dry climate, the great storage that the bunkers provide
The Red Cross is currently using a couple of these bunkers for some storage of equipment, and that's the type of business we would like to go out and seek, that we think this has good potential for support to both at a larger FEMA scale, support to the Portland, Seattle metro areas, as well as Spokane, Boise, in the event of a larger type of a catastrophe, that this would be a good site to for staging and of materials and personnel. Currently, we are doing a number of studies to move this action along. We have a property survey of the 7,500 acres that's underway. We are doing an electrical infrastructure study, a water assessment study, a rail study, and we are partnering with ODOT and a transportation study. So there are a number of things that need to occur to make this successful in the future. As Mr. Chance has indicated, it's older infrastructure, although the dry climate has preserved it quite well. But there will need to be some investment made in the future to make it a 21st century training site. So a couple of future actions, planning actions that are being considered. There's infrastructure improvements to the tune of about $6 million that we anticipate over the next decade we would need to make. We are also been very aggressive on the energy side. We are part of the Army's Net Zero program as a pilot in that program. And in the energy lane, there's a biomass cogeneration combined heat and power plant that we are high on the list to receive money for that would be located here and would help us sort of bring the energy infrastructure here into the 21st century. It'd be a renewable source, and it's about a $6.5 to $7 million project that we are hoping to get the property transfer done this year, with the thought that in FY15 or 16 we may be funded for that project. So aggressively pursuing that. And then there are some smaller projects that relate more to the training for FEMA Region 10 type activities, such as something called a structural collapsed vertical structure, which is a Army term for a rubble pile, so that we'd be able to train soldiers. We have what's called a surf pier here in the state. In the event of a seismic catastrophe where buildings collapse and you have to practice extraction, vertical extraction, other activities, this would be a training structure that would allow us to train those type of activities. So these are some of the actions that we're looking to sort of bring to bear at Umatilla to help bring jobs and dollars to the region.
Okay, questions?
Mr. Chief,
yes.
If I may, a couple things. We are, locally, we are very, very appreciative of what the Oregon National Guard has done. There are three things that they have done. First of all, I might mention that the housing project for the base, when it was developed, my Uncle Stafford and my dad bought it in the late 50s. Single-story, concrete brick houses, a typical government deal, bought the whole housing project and turned it into what at the time was the largest hog operation in the United States. Uncle Stafford oftentimes talked about land use planning. How'd you like me to live next to you? And so during my summers while attending the University of Oregon, I'd work down there. And every Thursday, I think it was, at 11 o'clock, there would be a horrendous boom. And what was happening is that in this corner, the Army was digging trenches, putting faulty, unused, whatever, munitions, and just igniting it. And there'd be a big black cloud, and then they'd do another trench, as I found out later. Well, it's just like clockwork. So when we began to do the reuse, we had a fairly significant area in that northwest corner on the DEQ hazard Brownfield, whatever it's called, one of the Superfund sites. So it would be absolutely impossible financially to clean that up. And so what the government was going to do is just fence it off and leave it there forever. Because while they said federal law says you're responsible for it, it didn't say any timeline when it had to clean. So the other issue is right here in the middle is K Block. The igloos are in ABC, real creative way of identifying, but K-Block was where all the munitions were. I guess it's more over here in the center. And so all the chemical weapons store. The third area was the headquarters, the cantonment area, down here in this part of the base, right off the freeway. We did not want to leave that infrastructure because other bases, when the Army left, pipes froze, leaks in the roof, you know, maintenance. So to their credit, and we really appreciate it, I want to call that out, the Oregon National Guard agreed to maintain that area, that's the caretaker. K block is not going to be a part of any development, even though it's clean, mentally, it chemical weapons were stored here. They're going to use that, and this is part of their training range. So it made use of that whole base in a way that we could use it because the Oregon military was agreed to take it over. So very appreciative of what they had to do, what they did.
That drove the shape of that military training. there was a reason for it.
So the ownership will transfer to the Oregon National Guard, or is it going to stay with the National?
Mr. Chair, the way we understand it, it stays basically in federal ownership, and we're licensed for it, is how it will eventually work.
We actually like that. Perspective, that's really nice, because they still have the responsibility to clean it at some point, and it's theirs. So
yes, sir. And the areas that the three areas that are needing further remediation are under contract and fully funded. That is, again, why we expect this to just the formal MOU to help just outline the roles and responsibilities in the future, but we're very comfortable with the road ahead on the environmental side.
Okay, that's very good. Any other questions?
Some of those circles in the south are part of our ranch. So.
I just want to say thanks because, getting to understand all these different aspects of Oregon are really important. And, Senator Hansel, thank you for being a 18-year investment of your life into this project as well. So, again, thanks for the information. And we're going to close the hearing, the informational meeting on the redevelopment of the Utah Chemical Bill. Thanks.
And
we will open up the rural revitalization initiatives in other states. Scott Hendrick, if you want to come forward, we're going to open that informational hearing. And we have been talking a lot about how do we revitalize Oregon, and one of the things that came up in our conversations was what's happened in other places. So we are thankful that our connection with the National Conference of State Legislators, NCSL, had some people who could help us with that. So this is a presentation about what's happening.
Great. Well, Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Hendrick, and I'm a program director at the National Conference of State Legislatures. I hope all of you have used NCSL in the past, but in case you haven't or don't know who we are the leading national bipartisan organization that was created to serve you all and state legislators and legislative staff around the country. And I think I'd be remiss at this point if I also didn't mention that your colleague, Senator Starr, is currently the president of NCSL, and he has done a lot to help our organization. And so it's nice for me to have a chance to come here and speak with you all and perhaps provide a little bit of payback to Oregon for Senator Starr's efforts on behalf of NCSL. So one of our main missions at NCSL is to share information on state policy approaches between states. And so this opportunity to speak to you today about rural affairs policies across the country is much appreciated. I've been asked to address what states are doing to promote agriculture tourism in particular as a way to slow rural population decline. And so my remarks today are going to focus on that issue. But at the end, if time permits, then I will certainly address some of the other trends that we're seeing in terms of other ways that states are trying to revitalize rural areas. Promoting rural economic health is, of course, a concern that is shared by policymakers in every state. I know the committee members are well aware of the challenges that are facing not only rural communities in Oregon, but across the country. In a vast number of these areas, jobs are harder to come by, infrastructure is crumbling and in need of repair, and populations are aging and shrinking. It's a big problem, and there are no easy answers. But that's why I particularly like this quote from a former Kansas state senator when talking about rural population decline and general rural economic development issues, that there is really no silver bullet solution to this, but there are a lot of things that can be done and answers to the problems that are posed by these questions. And the economics of rural America is changing. Whereas decades ago, rural economies relied heavily on farm-based jobs, that is now no longer the case. In fact, nationwide, 4 out of 5 rural economies are dominated by non-farm activities, including manufacturing, services, and government jobs. And for the most part, these are service-heavy jobs and also very technologically dependent jobs. And so that is quite a shift from what we saw decades ago in rural America. And an important part of the picture of this new rural economies is rural tourism and recreation. Recent federal government studies have found that tourism and recreational development in rural areas leads to a number of benefits to the local community. These include increases in employment, income and wage levels, and improvements in social conditions such as poverty, education, and health. So it's an important area to focus on. Of course, I certainly couldn't begin to provide a comprehensive overview of not only all the agritourism policies in the states, but also all the rural development policies in the states, given the limited time of the committee hearing this morning. But what I wanted to do was to just provide an overview of how states are approaching this issue and to highlight some select policy approaches that states are taking. And, of course, with any of the programs or policies that I discussed today, I'm happy to provide additional backup information and detail to the committee following the hearing today. So we'll start by taking a look at what some states have adopted in terms of comprehensive rural agritourism plans, and then look at some of the common elements that we'll see that we see in some of those plans. So there have been a number of states in recent years that have focused their efforts to promote agritourism. In the past 10 years or so, states such as Indiana, Vermont, Kentucky, Tennessee, and some others as well have pursued comprehensive approaches to developing and promoting rural tourism opportunities in their states. When looking at the approaches that these states have taken, a few common elements can be found. That is not to say that all states pursuing comprehensive policies share identical policies and programs, but there are commonalities that tend to show up in these states. First, many states have started comprehensive approaches by forming working groups or task forces to study rural tourism and identify a path forward. For example, Kentucky created its Kentucky Agritourism Working Group to begin exploring ways, quote, to improve and promote the viability of statewide agritourism industry sector in Kentucky. Indiana, Tennessee, and other states took a similar first step. Working group members usually include members of state agencies, such as representatives from departments of agriculture, tourism, natural resources, and economic development, and others, as well as local and regional community groups, university extension programs, and then, of course, agritourism operators themselves. Once created, these working groups usually started by doing an inventory of the current agritourism operations in the state in order to understand the industry and identify opportunities for future development. In Tennessee, the working group initiated a study to, quote, identify characteristics of the agritourism industry in Tennessee and to identify issues and obstacles faced by agritourism enterprises that may be addressed through research, teaching, and outreach. These studies lay the groundwork for developing a plan for moving forward to promote and expand agritourism in the state. And this is usually when the state legislatures get more heavily involved. Often, working groups will develop recommendations for additional legislation to help promote the agritourism industry. For example, in Indiana, following their studies that the working group made, they passed successful legislation that did two things. One, it established 2 permanent agritourism positions in their Indiana Tourism Council. And secondly, it called for the adoption of a statewide agritourism plan. Other states have statutes that call for similar statewide plans. In general, these plans set strategies for marketing and promotional activities, public relations and outreach, training and certification programs for agritourism owners and employees, and partnerships with local regional organizations. In general, these plans help coordinate activities among the various state agencies and between state and local governments. If members of the committee would be interested in seeing some examples of these statewide plans, I'd be happy to submit them to the committee. I'll now start to focus on some of the individual policies that we see that are in some cases part of statewide comprehensive plans, but there are a number of states out there that haven't passed comprehensive statewide agritourism plans, but nonetheless have picked and choosed at some of these policies and adopted them. And so I did want to note that this isn't particular to those states that have comprehensive plans. But the first policy that I wanted to point out is one that we've seen actually in 19 states, and these are policies that limit the liability of agritourism operators. For the most part, these limit civil liability arising from injuries caused by, quote, inherent risks associated with the activities at these agritourism facilities. And these activities generally are defined in statute to include farming and ranching activities, viewing historic, cultural, or natural attractions, harvest your own activities, or animal exhibitions. Usually, roadside produce stands or retail merchandise or food sales are not covered by these laws. The inherent risks that they're talking about that these laws address include unpredictable animal behaviors, natural conditions of the land, ordinary dangers of farm equipment and facilities, and the potentials for participants in agritourism activities to act negligently or to disregard safety warnings.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
How did you want to do questions? Do you want to wait for the presentation?
I'm happy to answer questions.
Sure. Yeah. So if we can do that, because we're actually looking at this here in our state as well.
Yes.
As you know from the chair, three of us serve on judiciary, and we've been asked to start looking at the liability issue. So regarding the inherent risk, is there limitations in the sense of, or some type of provisos in some of these plans? If the owner, operator knows that there's some type of a risk there, that they then have a duty to act?
Yes. Usually there's a couple of ways that these laws are limited. One is that they require the owners or operators to post warning signs. Mm-hmm. But in other cases, not uniformly, but in other cases we're seeing state laws where they require that the owner or operator keep their site in good working order. In order so that there are no unusual safety issues associated with the site.
Not a blanket free of liability.
No, it's not. It's not a blanket free free of liability. In many cases,
but
thank you. So yes, so I did just mention that there are warning signs that are required that the agritourism operators post in order to be covered by this
right.
liability as well. So another important thing that some states have chose to do is to look at exemptions from food laws. Of course, one of a major activity of agritourism is to promote farm-to-consumer direct sales of food. So this can be through farmers markets or when participants come on site to agritourism facilities. Oftentimes, there's opportunities to eat food or to purchase food on site. With these, that has caused an issue for some agritourism operators, and that they felt that they were unable to comply with some of the food safety inspection requirements that were really written in some cases to target the bigger retail food chains. And so there are quote unquote cottage food laws that have been passed in a number of states, and we're seeing more and more in recent years that would exempt these farm retailers from having to comply with every step of the food safety and really the inspection requirements that are often included in these laws with regards to, making sure that health officer has come by and check the kitchen and equipment and all of those things. And so, of course, there are some public health advocates who feel like this is potentially risky laws and that it increases the risk for foodborne illness by exempting certain operators from having to comply with the food safety laws. But that is certainly something that some states are looking at and addressing.
We've done some
yeah. Yep. Another one is compliance with building standards for commercial business operations. That's another area where states have allowed existing farms to be exempt from some requirements. For example, in Maryland, the state building code has a number of building requirements for businesses. These relate to issues such as how many bathrooms there are going to be, that there are sprinkler systems installed for fire safety reasons, and other issues. But for many agritourism operators, their buildings are first and foremost farms and not consumer businesses or places where people would come to visit regularly. And so requiring these businesses or these buildings to meet the modern requirements of business facilities would prohibit some agritourism operations from being able to start. And so states like Maryland have moved to exempt agritourism operations from these requirements. But the law still required that even for exempted facilities, that the agritourism operators keep those facilities structurally sound and in good repair. So there is, again, a limitation on that. Another potential obstacle that states have addressed relates to local laws and ordinances that might impose other requirements that would limit the ability of agritourism operations in the states. These could not only be building codes and zoning laws, but health and safety requirements or noise ordinances. Some states have moved to preempt local authorities from passing laws that would conflict with statewide efforts to promote agritourism. For example, a Florida statute preempts local regulations that, quote, prohibits, restricts, regulates, or otherwise limits an agritourism activity on land classified as agricultural land. In Virginia, state law prohibits local regulation of usual and customary, that's in quotes, usual and customary, agritourism activities at wineries unless there is a, quote, substantial impact on health, safety, or welfare to the public. And then finally, a North Carolina statute authorizes cities to amend ordinances applicable within their planning jurisdictions to provide, quote unquote, flexibility to farming operations that are located within the city. And amendments to applicable ordinances may include provisions regarding on-farm sales, pick-your-own operations, road signs, agritourism, and other activities incident to farming. Another approach that states have taken is to exempt agriculture operations from certain business taxes. An example of this is in South Carolina, where a statute exempts agritourism operations from certain business taxes so long as that operation is, quote, supplemental and incidental to the primary agricultural purpose of the land. And so we see that in a number of states where they provide certain benefits to agritourism industries, but so long as that's not the primary purpose of the land and the actual farming or ranching of the land is still the primary purpose. Another issue that we've seen is that states have established statewide agritourism promotional websites. I think this is very common across the states, and they serve multiple purposes. One is to keep an inventory of the agritourism operations in the state. Another one is that states can, in some cases, states have required agritourism operators to register with the states, and in that those laws sometimes require a registration fee, and in some cases we've seen states that say there will not be a registration fee, but it's a matter of keeping an inventory of the operators that are doing business in the state. And then a second primary purpose of these online websites is to market the industry to state, national, and international market audiences. So website features include the ability to search by geographic area or type of business, features highlighting individual agritourism operations, and newsletters to help raise the profile of the industry. Another interesting example of some laws to help promote agritourism that we saw there were a couple states that had laws that required signage to be posted that would direct people on highways and major roads to area agritourism operations. And the way this worked is that once an operator registered with the state, then they would have to pay a fee that would be used to help cover the costs of putting up the signs, and then they would also have to pay an annual fee after that to to cover the maintenance of the signs as well. So that's just another way that, and in this case, it was Alabama and Georgia have these types of laws, and it's a way to help raise the profile of the agritourism businesses in their state. And then finally, we have we've seen some grants where states are making grants to bolster the promotional materials that help promote the agritourism industry in the states. One example is with regional development districts. These districts serve as regional resource centers and provide planning, community and economic development, and technical assistance to local governments that are members of the district. And these districts are vehicles or can be vehicles to provide assistance to agritourism promotion organizations. And so in Pennsylvania, they established by statute a law that authorizes grants to local development districts for the development of regional tourism brochure and a map designating the historic sites and tourist attractions within that region. So I wanted to just, that's sort of just a quick overview of some of the policies that we've seen in other states along the agritourism area. I wanted, with the little bit of time I had left, to just talk briefly about some other trends that we're seeing in rural development, and I'd be happy again to provide a little bit more information for the committee on these issues. But we're seeing a few things, and I think where in the past with rural development policies usually tended to focus on farm increasing farm-based incomes and profits and opportunities with economic issues related to farming. I think now we're seeing really a shift away from that, and really some of the trends that we're seeing in terms of state policy are states that are looking at helping support the more service-based and technology-dependent industries in the states. And there are a few things that I wanted to point out. One is rural entrepreneurship is a really big focus in a lot of states, and trying to kickstart entrepreneur programs in rural communities as a way to draw in both new businesses and also to kickstart businesses among people who are still living in rural areas is really something that states are beginning to focus on. And so we're seeing state programs that are initiating training programs to help people understand entrepreneurship and creating business plans and how to market those plans. And then we're also seeing technical assistance that states are providing through, again, sometimes these regional or local authorities that can sometimes be sector-based depending on if there's a particular industry in the area that they're providing technical assistance to, or in some cases it's also based on the stage of development of a program. So whether it's helping them create the business plan or helping them develop a marketing strategy, those are the types of technical assistance that states are providing resources to support in local communities. And then the other thing outside of the entrepreneurship development, and it's related, is this idea of developing clusters of businesses in rural areas. And these are business enterprise or innovation zones where you would bring together businesses to an area where there are, usually it's around where universities, colleges, or technical schools are located. So you have a base of skilled workers who are available to help feed the industry. And the idea being that if you bring a number of different businesses together that are related either again by sector or in some way, that they can help feed off each other and really promote rural economic development in those areas. And so we're seeing also a lot of reliance on community colleges in this area to help develop specific programs and trainings to help prepare the workforce for future employment in these clusters. And then we're also seeing states pass tax benefits to help lure in businesses to these areas. So with that, I see my time's pretty much up. So I'd like to finish my comments, but I'm happy to answer any other additional questions.
Yes, Senator Berger.
More of a comment and information for the committee. So in my district, the ag tourism won't play a big role because we simply don't have a lot of agriculture. Mm-hmm. Most all the land is vertical.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a lot of mountains and rivers and stuff like that, and we have some tourism. But, you know, as we go through this discussion of the timber industry leaving, and I keep having people saying, oh, we need to do more tourism, the problem is we're really maxed out with tourism in my district because there's some hurdles. And one of the hurdles is it's seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously it's seasonal. And it just really creates seasonal part-time work, and that's actually how they usually advertise the positions, seasonal part-time.
Yes.
So they're not real good jobs. They're entry-level jobs, you know. And then the third thing that we're really experiencing and why we're maxed out is because of all the federal and state regulations. So we can't put any more people on the rivers. We're pretty well maxed out. Hmm. And so we're just about there. In fact, we're struggling to hang on to some of the tourism we have now because they want to cut back on how much we use these resources.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're challenged with tourism in my district. Just simply, one, we don't have the agriculture.
Yep.
And two, is because of all the regulations that are starting to be put on all these natural resources that are restricting how many people we so we're pretty much maxed out.
Yeah. Yeah. If I may, you know, that is certainly a challenge with some of the, with tourism industries in general, particularly those that revolve around seasonal activities. I think probably in terms of, well, maybe I'll just cut my comments off there.
Yeah, and the person that's running the business might make a pretty good living, but all the people they employ have a hard time.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, would it be possible, I know the NCSL does put together different tablets or forms of information.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff you went over, the number of states, at least 19, that have some type of ag tourism.
Yes.
Could you put that together for us so we could actually?
Absolutely. I could list you the states right now, but probably what would be more helpful is to give you a stack of the laws.
Yes.
And how they actually. I'd be happy to do that. I could do that.
And then also, while we're doing some work here in the state, would you be willing to work with other interested parties that were working with us to help facilitate information? Because one of the things I've tasked them with is to check to see what's happening in other states.
Absolutely. We'd be happy to do that. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Especially on the issue of liability and that other kind of stuff. This is a big part of what we're doing with the judiciary. So.
Yeah. And I'll just make a note. I think probably you're aware of this, but as an organization, we're here to provide information and analysis. We don't work to promote or advocate
right.
particular
yeah.
positions.
That's what
but we're happy
to That's what we want.
Just we're happy to do this. We're happy to do that.
Okay. And the other information that you'd like to provide, we will have you get it through our staff, and then they can get it distributed to
okay.
the rest of us.
Okay, great.
That would work pretty well. And you want to work with Senator Brzezinski to make sure that the people get who needs to get? No? Okay. That would be great.
Great.
Again, any other further questions about? Thank you very much for coming here, and we do appreciate NCSL, and I know that our senator is having a good time. Again, thank you for being here. We'll close our informational meeting on rural revitalization initiatives. And we're going to open an informal meeting on innovative infrastructure financing, House Bill 2345. Easiest number to remember, everybody tells me. 2345 is the easy bill number. So we're going to open that informational hearing. And Karen Williams, who's kind of running the whole show here, will be here to give us a little explanation. And again, this is a... because of this special session, and I mean not specialism, the annual sessions, everything is moving at such a higher pace that I think it's making people, I know some of my local people are getting nervous about these different things, and I thought it was better to give more information to people because before they blink, something new is coming in as a legislative agenda, and they would like us to take a breath and look at it more closely. So that's why we're having this meeting today. I wanted people to understand what's going because there are people who are pushing for stuff to happen in 2014 and 2015, and you have a job to do. So let us explain to us what's going on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Williams. My office is in Portland, Oregon, and I am the staff director of the House Bill 2345 Task Force. When House Bill 2345 was adopted by the legislature, it was obviously in recognition that Oregon has significant infrastructure needs. The numbers on your slides are from the American Society of Civil Engineers report about Oregon, but anecdotally we hear from many jurisdictions that, if anything, these numbers are probably underestimating the actual needs in Oregon. The the conclusion that we've all come to was, sure enough, Einstein was right. Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, I think he called it insanity. We'll be a little more respectful in today's conversation. So the conclusion that is represented by the work under House Bill 2345 and initiatives in the executive branch are that Oregon must innovate to get more value for our infrastructure dollars if we're to preserve our quality of life and have a sound and resilient economy. The strategies to create higher value for money and attract private capital are twofold. The first is to collaborate to establish a best practices marketplace so that Oregon, as a smaller jurisdiction, can have the benefits of attracting private capital by being consistent with a larger market and so predictable to private capital and an attractive market. That effort is through an entity called the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. The other strategy is to use best practices for innovative procurements when they are appropriate, which is certainly not for all projects, to procure infrastructure on performance outcomes and to achieve the highest value for our dollars by contemplating the entire life cycle of infrastructure. The strategy for accomplishing that is to create Infrastructure Innovation Oregon, or I2O, which is conceived to be a statewide center of expertise modeled somewhat after Partnerships British Columbia. I think you all heard during the discussions about House Bill 2345 about Partnerships British Columbia, which has been a wonderful partner to the executive branch in working on these ideas. The toolkit from the National Conference of State Legislators has also been a key piece of research material for the 2345 task force and something that these ideas are based upon as well. Creating a statewide center of expertise is a particularly important component of the strategy because in order to appropriately manage risk and leverage private capital in a way that is actually beneficial for the state, we need to have effective risk management and make sure that our work across the state and on all projects that are done with innovative procurement uses best practices. By doing that, we can assure the highest value for infrastructure dollars and accelerate the delivery of projects. But if this work is not done well, then the risks may not be appropriately managed. We may not achieve the outcomes that we want. So the concept is to improve our outcomes by implementing life cycle procurement following the Partnerships BC model when it is appropriate. This method allows private sector competition to achieve innovation and performance outcomes that, for some projects, traditional procurement doesn't meet those needs. It allows a transfer of risk for on-time, on-budget delivery and quality to the private providers, and assures performance by placing private capital at risk with penalties for non-performance. It allows us to stretch public dollars by leveraging private capital so that we can accelerate the development and delivery of projects and to achieve higher value for money because projects are designed to reduce long-term costs, not just to achieve the least cost of construction. I'd like to expand on that a little bit. The concept of performance-based life cycle infrastructure differs from traditional procurement in that the public owner, and these projects are publicly owned throughout their life, this is not about privatization, it's about a better model of procurement. The public owner develops very detailed performance requirements and puts those performance requirements out to the private sector and says, bring us your best innovation, bring us your best design, construction, and long-term maintenance considerations for these projects to get us the highest possible value for money. So the drivers of value for money differences looking at a traditional project and innovative finance mean that when these risks are retained or transferred, and when the base costs may be reduced or the same, in some cases maybe more depending on what the project is, but the idea is that the right project for innovative procurement is one where taking the overall picture of the life cycle of the project, there is higher value for money because of this combination of events, not just looking necessarily at least cost of construction at the moment of delivery. I'm sure we would all agree when we want something to last for 50 or 75 years, we don't necessarily buy the cheapest thing we find. We buy the best thing that we can find considering its life cycle and replacement costs as well as its initial costs of construction. So when the governor and the treasurer's office asked me to help them think about this, they said, should we invent this? And my answer was, probably not. When the question is, can we copy the A student's homework and do a better job of it? My answer was, yes, I think that's a great idea. So we have partnered with Partnerships BC. They have now accomplished over 40 projects, $17.5 billion in value in approximately 12 years, bringing $7 billion of private capital into BC. Those projects have generated significant benefits for taxpayers. They've achieved greater value for money, reduced and managed long-term risk, and created certainty of project cost and schedule. All of Partnerships BC's projects have been delivered on time and on budget. The method crosses sectors. It is a methodology, not an approach that is unique to any particular type of infrastructure. Some of their examples are the Surrey, this is a sensitive keyboard. the Surrey Pretrial Services Center expansion was, in traditional procurement, would have cost $148 million. By DBFM, cost $133 million instead, was delivered approximately a year ahead of schedule, and had significant safety improvements because of private innovation in design of the building. The Sea to Sky Highway was a $600 million project that had an urgent schedule in order to be completed in time for the Olympics. They knew that they needed significant safety improvements on that 60 kilometers, it's about 100 kilometers of road, about 60 miles. But they needed more passing lanes, median barrier safety markings, and the Ministry of Transportation knew that they couldn't get everything they needed for their $600 million. They put it out for performance-based procurement and added approximately $100 million in additional value and delivered it on time. These projects are publicly owned. The taxpayer risk is reduced through long-term performance contracts that have the effect of a cash-backed warranty because of the presence of private capital. That achieves higher value for money, not only because of the warranty, but also because it invites innovation in design to think about the entire life cycle of a project, and it allows acceleration and that innovation by leveraging private capital. The House Bill 2345 Task Force is addressing these issues by the design of this sibling entity or similar entity to Partnerships BC. Our working title up until about a week ago was Partnerships Oregon. With the advice of Senator Reid and others on the task force, we're now considering a more distinctive name that is more Oregon, that I2O or Infrastructure Innovation Oregon. Modifications to existing contracting statutes to allow similar outcomes. The ODOT has statutes that have been in Oregon since 2003 for innovative partnerships in transportation. That statutory program was more focused on toll road P3 style, which involves some privatization. It has not been used extensively in Oregon, though there have been a few projects. But we looked at that statutory construct, the work that Partnerships BC does, the method of procurement, the Long Beach Courthouse project, which was done in California using this method of procurement, the work of the National Conference of State Legislatures, Brookings, Rockefeller, and others, to think about what modifications to those statutes would enable these outcomes, and also participation in the West Coast Exchange. The co-chairs of House Bill 2345 are Representative Tobias Reed and Ms. Rakiya Adams, who's the Director of Investments for the Standard Insurance Company. I'm the staff director, and the DAS oversight is through Sarah Miller, who's Michael Jordan's deputy. Mr. Arthur Towers is in the room, who is a member of the task force.
John
Rakowitz from the AGC is not a member of the task force, but is a regular participant, and has the AGC and others have been providing input to the task force. And some of the input, Senator Roblin, as you commented, is this is going at a very fast pace. So the opportunity to speak with you and answer your questions is one members of the task force value very much. Thank you for making the opportunity. But we also are doing everything we can to collaborate with League of Oregon Cities, other stakeholders, organized labor, the AGC, other stakeholders who have concerns and interest in this activity. As we work on drafting a legislative proposal, we'll do everything we can to gain the input from those stakeholders.
Questions?
Yes. Yeah, I guess more of a comment or end question. I thought that we as a state are already embarking in this area in some like in transportation projects as well as some construction projects.
I don't know that we have had any of them with a with the kind of project that says over the life of this history of this project, we're sharing the risk with the private investment money. I don't think that we have any of those at this time.
No.
No.
That's what part of this is all about.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pruzanski, you may be thinking of the early collaboration that's going on with the Multnomah County Courthouse. I think this committee was aware of that, and that is advancing. Now, it's gone through a screening report that was done by Partnerships BC, and they have the state through the Department of Administrative Services and Partnerships BC have signed an intergovernmental agreement that now allows any government entity to work with Partnerships BC by doing an amendment or a task order to that intergovernmental agreement. The business case analysis for the Multnomah County Courthouse, that is a full detailed analysis of traditional procurement compared to innovative procurement, is going to commence in the next few weeks. And the outcome of that will be a recommendation to the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners about the optimum procurement method to follow.
So I guess what I'm hearing, maybe the difference from what I remember, is that we had procurements that were occurring, but they were basically making, let's say, building a building for a state entity and then walking away from it.
Correct.
Now they're going to have some ownership in the ongoing responsibilities and
that's
risk.
What this one does, yeah.
Yes, Senator, if I may, it's not ownership as it is capital that's provided to the state or the sponsor entity really in order to effect a cash-backed warranty.
Okay, thank you.
There is risk. But if it all works out, they actually benefit. So that's why the people are willing to invest the money, because they can get a return on that money,
right,
by getting things done on time and in costs, all those kinds of things. The issue is, you know, from a lot of our Dever people is, how does that relate to our contractors in Oregon? Will they be able to participate in these kinds of things? Will they won't? How about, where's the capital going to come from? Is it, you know, big, huge national groups? And I think that's why we have people like Ms. Adams and others, because they do have sources of resources that could be invested in these kinds of things. So.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the experience of Partnerships BC is that more than 80% of the work is done by local firms, and more than 90% of the people who are hired on these projects are residents of the jurisdiction. And by local firms, Ms. Clark, the CEO of Partnerships BC, is careful to frame that as firms that have a presence, an office presence or business presence in BC. Some of them may be components of larger firms, but that have a presence in BC.
And those are some of the issues that we need to look at.
Yeah, I mean, that's some of the stuff I think most of us probably have heard from some of the smaller general contractors. That they feel under the current procurement that we do have, that they're not at the table because they haven't made a certain grade, and then at best they may get a sub contract out of something.
Yeah, and so it's kind of looking at all that stuff, and I think that's important to all of us. And again, I feel like we need to keep this out in the open so people know what's coming, because things come through these sessions fairly quickly without knowing what's going on. And I really appreciate the fact that you've been having these meetings, and people are engaged in being there. And I know as a member and sitting in that committee, and I've been coming down, I've sort of done mostly by phone, I'm looking to hear from a bunch of other people between now and the next meeting so I can bring up ideas.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Przanski, if I may clarify, that this methodology is really suitable for projects with a budget of $50 million and above. The local participation, just as with a traditionally procured project of that scale, the number of general contractors in Oregon who would be taking appropriate business steps to do a project of that scale, it certainly is not every general contractor in Oregon who would do that. High participation is both in some local general contractors, but many, many subcontractors, as would be with a traditional procurement and a project of that scale.
Well, I think the point here is that at least some of the people I've heard from over the years is that they feel, even though they're local and it's supposedly going to have local people actually doing the work, they're not actually getting it like at the universities when they're putting a building in. I mean, this is stuff we're here. I mean, you're always going to have people marketing, positioning, etc. But it does seem like if there's a way that we can ensure that individual skilled workers that live in a community actually have an opportunity to get onto a job site, as compared to having other people have to come in and be there just for the task at hand and then move on, it seems like it gives a little bit more for the community.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of this in this whole thing. The other one is apprentices. Whether you have enough apprentices, if you have enough work, and the local people can hire apprentices. I mean, all of those things to keep our workforce up are important components to all this kind of stuff. And so, I mean, I think it's important to have the conversations. And I think that the conversations are really important with this one. I was in a conference last week in Tenoir and talked to a couple of people from BC. BC is pretty high on it. The people there are it's worked to this point, and it's fairly young. I mean, those projects have not gone through their life cycle yet, so we don't know what that risk really is going to happen. So, but they're, the people who I talked with are kind of high on it in BC. They think it's working pretty well. And BC is looking for more connections with the states. It's been interesting for me. All the western provinces are feeling like they want to have relationships with the western states, because they feel the same with their federal government as we do, in that most of the votes are on the east side. So they get...
Maybe we ought to succeed.
Anyway, so it's been an interesting conversation.
Cascadia.
I think, if I may make a final point, there's an important distinction, too, between this kind of procurement and the kind of old-school P3 privatization procurement that has created lots of problems. Some great outcomes as well, but has also created some controversies and problems. And one of the real keys to this procurement is that projects continue to be publicly owned. So the high road contracting benefits that we think of that drive benefits into communities still apply. And I think that's an important distinction.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Appreciate it very much for being here today.
So my pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to close our informational meeting on innovative infrastructure financing, and we're going to open a post-wildfire land management informational meeting, a conversation with some of our people from the different agencies, Doug Decker, Michael Hask, and Bill Adams. So we have BLM, Department of Forestry, and Roseburg Forest Products. And I appreciate all of you being here, and I appreciate the opportunity to have a conversation.
Thank you. So, down the arrow.
Welcome.
All right.
Multiple administrators?
Yes, we do. We are fortunate to have multiple administrators.
Here we are. Good morning, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Bertrager, members of the committee, Beth. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester, the Director of the Department of Forestry. We're here this morning to discuss with you the rehabilitation of lands burned by fire this summer. I'm going to specifically talk a little bit about state forest lands. I think it would be helpful to put the state forest losses in some perspective, and so I'm going to do that with a couple of slides here. Here's the numbers. You know, we did have a major lightning storm that swept through southwest Oregon on July 26th, and you'll recall that on the 26th we had literally tens of thousands of lightning strikes that started more than 80 fires on lands protected by the Douglas Forest Protector Association and the Department of Forestry. What we're looking at here is statewide totals, but the vast majority of our fires burned this summer in southwest Oregon. That's where our costs and our losses were. Most of the fires that we had were stopped when small. We had more than 1,000 fires that we kept at less than 10 acres. That's our job. A few of them, a small handful of them, led to the damage that we're going to talk about here this morning. This is pretty much a rough tabulation. If you look at the state perspective, which I'm going to drill into here, the state-owned lands, 400 acres of state forest burned, and that includes about 80 acres of common school lands, and you'll recall that we, ODF, manage those on behalf of the State Land Board and the Department of State Lands, and about 320 acres of Board of Forestry lands. So the map will show us really the large fires that we contended with in southwest Oregon. And just for orientation, Grants Pass is kind of at the bottom of the map where I-5 turns off to the west there. Roseburg is kind of off the map to the north there. These seven fires or so burned a total of about 70,000 acres. The Board of Forestry lands that were burned, these 400 acres that I'm going to talk briefly about this morning and set the stage for my colleagues here, was really it's the blue lands, those blue lands, and they were primarily in the Dad's Creek fire. Dad's Creek and Rabbit Mountain were kind of lumped together to be the Douglas complex. And the Board of Forestry lands and the Common School lands were kind of split out there between Brimstone and Dad's Creek. As you hear the three of us talk this morning about salvage of these lands and recovery, you're going to hear the range of landowner objectives, and something that I like to have to remind folks about is that there's a range of different possible objectives for landowners in Oregon. It's not all one objective. Federal land management agencies have different objectives than private landowners, then different than state-owned forest landowners. So as you hear us talk about our salvage and rehabilitation plans, you're going to hear echoes of those land management policy differences, which are not right or wrong necessarily, but they are what they are because we have different land management objectives and goals. And I just want to put that in perspective. Let's get into a little more detail. I'm going to talk about the state forest pieces, and my colleagues are going to talk about a couple of the other pieces. On state forest lands, I'll begin by pointing out that about half of our 400 acres were severely burned, with about half of those acres being salvageable. About 200 acres we found that we were able to do some salvage on. These are areas where the timber is still mature enough commercially. It has matured enough commercially to be merchantable,
and or it wasn't too heavily damaged by fire. We are moving ahead directly and immediately with salvage sales in these areas, and I'll show you a few pictures and a little more details in just a moment. But the goal there is to try to capture some of the economic value on those lands, as well as to help us prepare those lands for replanting over the next year or two. So we did have our salvage plans from the revenue side of what we hope to gain. We have just under about 1 million board feet that we'll be salvaging over the next couple of years that should generate about $250,000. So that's on those acres that are salvageable. On the acres that are less severely burned, the trees are going to survive. We do have management options available for the future, and that includes the full spectrum of things that we do, thinning, regeneration harvest. These stands are still intact. And I want to point out, I'll show you an aerial photograph in a moment. In some cases, these are also stands that have been previously thinned. And I think that's an important point when it comes to fire spread. Where our disheartening losses were really in our younger stands that were severely burned. We've got many fewer opportunities there. They're going to require a range of different types of treatments and replanting, and we're going to do what's necessary to get those lands back online. But in addition to the lost younger stands that are younger than 30, 35 years, we have what I would refer to as sunk costs that we've put into those lands that we cannot capture any economic value from, initial reforestation costs, stand management costs, and other costs that are just sunk and lost over time. We'll never be able to recover those. So just looking at kind of a before and after picture, this is in the Dad's Creek fire, the one of the two Douglas Complex fires. This gives us a sense, the blue lines here. This is about 160 acres of state-owned forest land that's outlined there in blue. Gives us a sense of the variability of the forest. You can see some merchantable timber down on the bottom far left-hand corner. You can also see some younger stands down there in the bottom, down in the bottom right-hand corner. And I would point out, just keep your eye on the thin stands on the far right side, of the of that photograph. We're going to go forward now and look at after, and you'll be able to see just some interesting fire behavior characteristics in there. Here's the aftermath of the fire. It was very hot in much of this area, and essentially the fire destroyed the youngest stands in this area, as well as the oldest stands. And again, if you're kind of keeping our eye on that bottom far right side, you can see that's a stand that had been thinned, and that actually did survive intact and presents us some opportunities going forward economically, environmentally, and in terms of social benefits as well. So we will we're going to restore all of these areas, and we'll be replanting where we need to. We'll be removing the standing non-merchantable trees, or in some cases just falling them in place, thinking about reforestation. How do we do our site preparation to get this land ready to grow again? We are proceeding directly with salvage, and we're incorporating the Endangered Species Act considerations that we need to make into our work. We did have several, we had three spotted owl sites that were in or near the burned stands, and right now we're working with our wildlife biologists to address owl habitat needs, including having a look at what is remaining as suitable habitat and what we can establish as specific core areas when possible. So we're in the process of doing that right now. Here's a list of some of the current actions that we have relative to the salvage sales that we're organizing. We've really organized our work here to accommodate factors such as the biological assessments that we're doing relative to the owl sites, as well as considerations about what sales we can feasibly operate in and get in and work during the winter, and as well as workload and capacity. So on the state forest side, just to sum up, the blue lines here being the areas where we will be doing some active, where we are have sales planned and underway, and some active units there. Damage was far more widespread on the other ownerships, which you're going to be hearing about here in a moment. This was a epic fire season. We haven't had a fire season like this since 1951 in terms of total acres burned. We've never had a fire season like this in terms of the costs, as well as the losses. And we're, over the next couple of days, Nancy Hirsch and I are going to be here talking next door and other rooms about the costs. And I think you're going to hear clearly this morning about the loss side. The loss side of the fire story really dwarfs the cost side. And, you know, I encourage you to listen to that, listen to particularly to Phil as he walks us through that presentation. We're actively working on salvage. Replanting is in the spring. We'll be putting these areas back on a pathway to achieving our policy, which is greatest permanent value on Board of Forestry lands, and we're well on the path to getting after that. Would be glad to answer any questions or comments, and then we'll turn this over to my colleagues here.
Yeah, go ahead. We'll have a couple questions now.
Doug, please. Do you off the top of your head know how much it's going to cost per acre to reforest the lands that have no salvage, the reprod that got wiped out?
Chair Robles, Senator Bertschinger, an estimate is somewhere in the neighborhood of those lands that we have to go in and fully replant, somewhere in the neighborhood of about $50,000 for the chunk of those lands that have to be reforested.
Do you have a by acre amount?
I don't have a per acre. It's very variable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't work out that easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is definitely a cost there.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Send a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fascinating slides. I really appreciate that. It really gives us a clear picture, especially of thinning. So, Doug, this question is about the loss of the one firefighter that was from my district. It was unclear to me whether his death was because of human error or equipment failure. And so I'm wondering about the status of our equipment in the state. Is it up to snuff, or do we need to do work in that area?
Chair Robles, Senator Close, the young man driving the water tender, I believe you're referring to. We have a significant commitment that all of us in the fire business make to safety. That is, it is job number one. You hear that every morning, every evening. It is in front of all of us, and when we lose a firefighter here in Oregon or in other states, it affects all of us, and I just want to just recognize that. From our contracting procedures to our training standards to our equipment standards, all of safety is kind of thread all through those. In many cases, we do utilize excess federal property, and which we transfer to a variety of different partners. I think, you know, capitalizing large equipment, whether it be in the fire business or in the forest product sector, remains a challenge for folks, particularly coming out of this economic hardship. I think the bottom line is that our fire managers are not going to be in a position to, they are not going to approve the use of equipment that isn't meeting those standards, and we have a deliberate and transparent process that we go through to evaluate equipment that we bring onto a fire.
So, was it human error or equipment failure? I don't know if you can say that or not.
Chair Robles, Senator Close, I know that there was an investigation that was completed. The Department of Forestry doesn't have jurisdiction over that. The contract was the equipment was not contracted under the Department of Forestry.
Okay.
So I'm not in a. I actually don't have the specifics on that in my head. I can get that for you and share with you the copy of that investigation report. It could be that one of my colleagues here at the table may know more about that report than I.
I don't. I'm sorry.
I can just speak from the cuff. I was back in Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago, and I did talk to the gentleman who was the team lead for the serious accident investigation. And at that time, Joe told me that he had not yet received some of the necessary reports to close out that accident investigation. So I'm not sure if that final report is available yet. That was what I know of a couple of weeks ago.
Thank you.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
For the record, Mike Haskey. I'll do a little introduction.
Yeah, in a minute. Yeah, thanks.
Any
other questions right now? Very good. We'll go on whoever wants to be next.
I'll go next, okay. I guess.
And Mike, if you could put the microphone out closer to you.
Going to need a little bit of help to find where the...
It's almost there.
Doug, will you do slides for
me? I will. Interagency collaboration. So
while we're waiting for bylaw presentation to load up, for the record, my name is Mike Haskey, and I'm the Deputy State Director for Resources for the Bureau of Land Management in Oregon and Washington. Since this is a new forum for me, I thought I'd do a little bit of self-introduction. I started my career in Medford, Oregon, my BLM career, as a forester. I've worked in our Medford and Roseburg districts. Went back east for a few years to work in our national office, and I've been in the state office for 9 years. So I just celebrated my 35th year of service with the Bureau of Land Management, and about 27 of those 35 years have been here in Oregon. So although I'm not a native Oregonian, I'm well-grounded in BLM issues in Oregon and Washington. My staff and I are responsible for policy and operational and budget direction for natural resource programs, all the natural resource programs that BLM manages in Oregon and Washington. It includes fire and aviation, threatened and endangered species, and forest management. I'm here today to talk about post-fire management from a BLM perspective, and as Doug already alluded, you'll hear some similar themes and you'll hear some different themes because the federal land managers do have some different direction for our lands. And I'm going to talk about the three fires in particular that Doug already mentioned, the Big Windy Fire, which was northwest of Grants Pass, the Douglas Complex, which was that Dad's Creek and Rabbit Mountain Fire, and then the Little Brimstone Fire. And although I'm focusing on those particular fires, the issues that I'll talk about are pretty generic to any kind of post-fire activity on any of our BLM lands in western Oregon. So there'd be common themes no matter where the fire was. I'm going to touch briefly through this presentation on the main considerations that we take into account when we're planning post-fire activity, and I'll just run through those really quickly, and then I'm going to have some slides to illustrate some of these issues. Safety, as Doug mentioned, big concern, and that's not only right now, that's for the future as well. So we need to look we need to look near-term and far-term as we think about safety in these fire-impacted areas. I'll talk a little bit about environmental degradation and our stabilization and recovery efforts. Doug already mentioned fire severity. I've got a few slides to talk about that. An important thing for the BLM, and this is where the difference in land management direction really comes in, is our underlying land use allocation. So our landscape, even though a lot of it is that checkerboard, we have different direction for different parcels of land that are mapped out. And I'm going to talk specifically about our matrix lands, which are lands that were identified via our land use plans for timber production, primarily for timber production. And I'm going to focus on late successional reserve lands, which were lands that were identified in our land use plans primarily for threatened and endangered species considerations. I'm also going to highlight the fact that we need in our management, Doug alluded to the Endangered Species Act compliance. We have another regulatory allocation over our land base, critical habitat, primarily for the spotted owl. There was, as far as I know, no marbled murrelet habitat impacted by these fires. Another consideration is the needs of our neighbors. That's extremely important in our checkerboard ownership. And I'm also going to just touch briefly that because of the high level of interest around post-fire activity, we have a history of litigation over post-fire activity and salvage sales. We've already started outreach efforts with key stakeholders and interested publics through Oregon Consensus. So we've been talking with the counties, the tribes, with industry, and with the conservation community. So if you'd go to the next slide. We foresters love numbers, and I realize this slide is pretty busy. It's got a lot of numbers, but I thought it would be present a graphic illustration of the complexity of what the BLM has to deal with when we're planning for post-fire activity. So I already mentioned the fires. The Big Windy Fire was predominantly or all on our Medford district. The Douglas Complex fires were on our Medford and Roseburg district, and a brimstone fire was on our Medford district. The big windy fire was predominantly, I talked about those land use allocations, predominantly late successional reserve, and it also impacted some of the wild and scenic river designation along the Rogue River. That fire was adjacent to the Rogue River. In fact, we closed the river for a while because of fire activities. About 28,000 acres, all said and done, on the Big Windy Fire. And if you remember Doug's map, that was largely block ownership of BLM. That's one of the few areas in the state where the BLM ownership isn't checkerboarded as heavily as the rest of our areas. The Douglas Complex was almost 49,000 acres. About half of that was on private land, 27 different landowners, and about half of it was on BLM land. Of the 25,000 acres on BLM, about two-thirds were in Roseburg, or in Medford, pardon me, and one-third in Roseburg. And in the Medford area, on the Medford district, it was primarily that matrix land use allocation, the lands that are dedicated to timber production. And in Roseburg, it was primarily late successional reserve. So the total for the three fires, speaking just from BLM acreage, about 54,000 acres, about 62% of that was in some sort of reserve land use allocation, and 38% was matrix lands. And of that 38% of the matrix lands, about half of that is in critical habitat, designated critical habitat for the northern spotted owl. So we have a lot of overlays on our land. You can see it gets pretty complex pretty quickly. I should have included a slide here. I didn't. One of our immediate requirements after the fire, within 14 to 21 days of containment, we have to prepare an emergency stabilization and rehabilitation plan and get it to our Washington office. So a few months ago now, we turned in a request of about $7.7 million for emergency stabilization and rehabilitation. And I just got information while I was back on my trip to D.C. that out of that $7.7 million, we got an allocation of about $1.6 million. Bureau-wide, the whole fund for all the Bureau lands in the U.S. is about $30 million for emergency stabilization and rehabilitation. So it's a pretty limited pot of money. And we've already implemented some of those activities, including slope stabilization, road repair. We're going to have needs for noxious weed treatment and, of course, reforestation. Doug, if you go to the next slide. So this is just a simpler slide, and it's considerations as we look out past the emergency immediate needs and what we're going to focus on. And it, once again, I broke it out by those two main land use allocations, the late successional reserves and the riparian areas. That's another land use allocation, riparian reserve, and then our matrix. So in our late successional and riparian reserves, our post-fire activity is going to focus primarily on long-term habitat recovery and conservation needs of listed species. We expect, I will say, I should step back just a minute here, for all these land allocations, safety is going to be a primary concern, as I already mentioned, short-term and long-term. So that's going to be in the mix. So going back to the late successional reserves, it's not an economic focus on those lands for output. It's, like I said, they're dedicated more towards recovery of listed species. And we expect that we will primarily, in addition to the work needed for safety issues, we will focus on areas of high severity burn. I'm told that the Big Windy Fire, which I have not visited myself, I've been to the Douglas Complex, but I'm told that from an ecological perspective, it's considered a fairly good burn, and the burn will help meet the objectives of that late successional reserve designation. In the matrix lands, we're going to focus on economic recovery. We will address more of the landscape, so we will be looking at low, moderate, and high severity burns. And we want to be timely because, as we all know, dead timber loses value quickly. So we want to be timely, and we're shooting for getting all our required environmental reviews completed and hopefully having projects on the ground by late summer, early fall of next year, although I will mention a few projects that we're going to have well before that. In fact, we're probably going to have some small timber sales next month. So that's about it for the text. I just have some slides now that I was hoping would illustrate some of the topics I talked about. And I wasn't quite sure how well these would show up. This is a slide of the Big Windy Fire that I mentioned, Lake Successional Reserve. That's the Rogue River at the bottom of the slide. And it shows, pretty low to moderate severity fire behavior in that area. So that's an area, once again, Wild and Scenic River as well. We expect, I don't want to be pre-decisional, but we expect that it's probably going to be fairly light touch on the Big Windy Fire. Next slide, just an example of a high severity burn. This was on the Douglas Complex. In real simple terms, high severity, if all the needles are gone, we call it high severity. If there's needles on the tree still, but they're orange, we call it moderate severity. And if it burned just underneath, we call it a low severity. So this is an area where we would consider much more especially if it's in the matrix for economic recovery and quick salvage. Next slide. This is an overlook from Rabbit Mountain, the Douglas Complex, and it highlights, I'm not sure how well that shows up. What I was trying to show is that there's a mosaic of burn types across these fires. Doug showed how thinning, and in his particular example, helped moderate fire behavior. We have boots on the ground right now looking at all these areas, looking at those different fire severities, putting our assessment together and making the plans to go forward with post-fire activities. So it's really important that we get a good hard look at this at the burns, that we map them out, and we put forward a proposal that the public and interested parties can understand, because we'll have to do environmental assessments that are open to public review and comment. Next slide. This is one of the safety issues. This just shows some areas where we had stumps in or close to the roadbed. They burnt out during the fire. Obviously, that's a safety hazard and an erosion hazard. Next slide is just another example of a stump hole caused when a stump in the roadbed burnt out. Next slide. I wanted to try to illustrate a few points on this slide. So this slide is it's a boundary between BLM land on the left side and private land on the right. I'm not sure of the private ownership there. But it illustrates a few things. Number one, when that's a steep slope, I believe that's the Cow Creek Road. It's a designated scenic byway. So there's traffic on that road. When we get a lot of moisture on that slope, it's going to have gravel. There's going to be a lot of stuff coming down. You can see we had some pretty high severity fire. So we have to think not only about the safety of our folks when they have to work on that ground, but our neighbors' folks when they have to work on their ground. So we have to think about those trees along the property line. And then, of course, on the ridgetop, if we ever get a reburn in there, we want to have an area that's safe for crews to get back in and work. So we have to consider that's that longer-term safety consideration that we're considering in our planning. So we want to be able to go in and treat those areas so that in the event of a reburn in 10 or 15 years or whenever, that we can safely put crews in there. I also wanted to mention that we've, because of the checkerboard ownership and the road goes in and out of BLM and private, working with our neighbors is really important. And we've had several, at least two or three meetings with our adjacent landowners, and we are coordinating on road maintenance issues and the safety issues. So we're not only have boots on the ground, we're doing a lot of coordination with people we need to talk about. The last thing I wanted to mention with this slide, we've already had a lot of discussion with Fish and Wildlife Service. So we want them to understand, and I think they do, the safety considerations in particular, the fact that we need to be treating some of these areas maybe a little bit more aggressively than they would like from a pure all standpoint, and I think they understand that. Next slide just highlights some hazard tree, potential hazard tree. So we intend to do hazard tree removal quickly and sell what timber is salvageable from that. So we're working on that. I have a couple. The next couple slides are just more examples of hazard tree. This is a picture near a road turnaround on a Douglas complex. Obviously, some safety hazard there. Next slide, just some more hazard tree scenarios on the Douglas complex. Next slide. When we built fire lines on these fires, at post-fire, we yarded the logs out to landing areas. So we do intend to sell those logs quickly, and that's one of the sales I mentioned we may have in maybe even this month. We're going to put up, I believe it's a million or two board feet of decked logs from fire line construction, and probably have some hazard trees mixed in there that were felled during the fire. So that's an immediate short-term economic boost. And then the last slide I have is just shows some of the slope stabilization work we're doing. We're directionally falling trees and putting in sediment traps. And I wanted to highlight in particular here that we have a veterans crew down in Medford who we're keeping actively employed doing this kind of work. They're a highly skilled crew, and it's a veteran crew, and we're giving them an opportunity to gain skills and perhaps even move into other jobs in the BLM other than firefighting. So coming up, we have continued coordination with our neighbors, a very important topic. We're working on the environmental review and assessment of the Brimstone fire. That was a smaller fire, about 2,100 acres, and we expect to have a salvage sale on that fire in April or May. We're starting the environmental assessment on the Douglas Matrix lands, with sales projected for late summer, early fall of next year, and we're looking at the LSR work. And the last thing I wanted to say is I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the great relationship we have with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I want to recognize the professionalism of their staff. It was an epic year. It's a historic fire season for them, and they certainly stepped up to the plate, and we look forward to our continued coordination with our private neighbors as well. So,
any questions right now?
I'll wait to.
Okay.
Well, good morning. For the record, my name is Phil Adams. I'm the land and timber manager for Rosework Forest Products. Thank you, Chair Roblin, for the opportunity to present to the committee. So my story is basically subtitled Picking Up the Pieces, and if Doug could forward that. If a picture can tell a thousand stories, this one does it for me. As a land manager, when I look at the landscape that we're managing in the ONC lands, I'm trying to put the rough overlay of the property lines onto that landscape just to show you what it's really like out there. It's a checkerboard ownership. You're looking in this picture at Rabbit Mountain proper, taken on July 26th at about 1:30 p.m. You can see roughly 4,000 acres of timberland ownership in that foreground. Half of it is BLM land. Half of it is Roseburg land. If you look real close at those property lines, that's basically a section, which is 640 acres of land. And you can see that you've basically got a landscape out there with two different landowners with two different land ownership objectives. On the BLM land, these particular areas are late successional reserve lands, where the federal government is managing according to the Northwest Forest Plan, basically for wildlife habitat. But directly adjacent to them is our private lands, which we're managing for timber production under the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Excuse me. Sorry to stumble there. And so you can see a complex arrangement of land based upon that topography, but we're both managing our properties, and while it's green and growing, things are pretty good. I mean, the BLM is working on their land, and we're working on our land. We're both accomplishing our management objectives and goals. But the common denominator that you see there that is foreboding our linked future is that I literally can count 10 ignition points from that dry lightning storm that happened on July 26th. And that's the game changer. And as you, Doug, if you could forward for me. These were powerful fires. Literally over the next 2 days, those two fires on Rabbit Mountain and Doug and Dad's Creek generated huge plumes, and what's happening at the base of those smoke plumes is nothing good. You're basically getting 100% mortality across all age classes. And the fire really didn't care about those property lines that I was showing. It was basically feeding on the fuels, the topography, and the weather that were driving its behavior. By the end of the second day, we literally had 26,000 acres of heavy to extreme damage timberland as a result of that. And I took the liberty to present a map set to the committee. At your leisure, you can see that fire progression map showing the core of those firestorm areas, and then also a map showing the severity of the burn within those firestorm areas, both kind of documenting the extreme damage that occurred in those areas. From our perspective, this is a catastrophic event. Forward, please. At the landscape level, severe damage across the ownerships, across the age classes, and certainly something that immediately changed our management plans. Go ahead, Doug. Because with inside the fire perimeter, we have 11,000 acres involved in the two separate fires. I queried our inventory database, and basically it shows that in this area, it's about a 30%, 70% split between what we call our merchantable timber class and our pre-merchantable timber class. So pre-merchantable timber it's vigorously growing, but it's young enough that it doesn't have a commercial product yet. Of those 7,500 acres, the average age of our involvement was 21 years old. On the merch side, we had about 40 million board feet of timber involved in the fire. Just to quantify this and put a little perspective on loss, it's all quantifiable. In our view, we can break it into two pieces. The merchantable component is basically recoverable. It's large enough that we can harvest it, convert that tree into a log, and send it to a sawmill where they'll convert it into a 2x4 or a piece of veneer. What we lost, it's basically an involuntary conversion. On the other hand, we lost the ability to schedule that harvest when we wanted to. But for the most part, we'll say that if we get in there and quickly salvage, we can recover the bulk of that value loss. On the other hand, the pre-merchantable component is a different animal. It really is unrecoverable. When they were green and growing, our stands had a fair market value in the marketplace. Basically, dependent on age, we had made the initial reforestation investment to get those lands stocked and productive with new vigorously growing stand of timber. And as an example, a five-year-old stand has a market value of $600, which is basically roughly the equivalent of the reforestation costs it takes to establish those acres on our sites and under our regimes. But quickly and over time, you can see that they gain value because they're green and growing. They have a projected yield of timber volume down the line. You can use a discounted cash flow methodology to determine what that value of that timber stand is today. And so a 20-year-old pole stand is on these sites is worth $1,800 roughly, and a 35-year-old small saw log stand could be worth $3,700. So the value loss is real, and from that perspective, the other piece that's incremental and quantifiable in our view is the loss of that current rotation's contribution to volume. Imagine that 25-year-old stand of timber that I was counting on to contribute to our harvest schedule in 25 years. I've lost that ability to schedule that now. It's really now I've got bare land that I'm going to have to make a secondary reforestation investment of about $600 an acre or two, and then be able to schedule that volume in 50 years. So you put that all together in a contributory kind of way. You can do the math as well as I can and kind of see the loss profile there that this fire represents to Roseburg. And so what do you do post-fire? For us, it's really not an option to do little, if anything. We won't grow snags and brush fields, but what we're going to do is pick up the pieces and reinvest. We'll roll up our sleeves, get dirty, and put together a three-year plan to basically get back to square one. For planning purposes, we're figuring this is about a $6 million capital investment, and it's basically the model that we'll follow is the one that's been replicated time and time again in Western Oregon. Address our roads and improvements, work towards a very quick and efficient salvage program to capture as much value as we can from our merchantable component, and then an aggressive reforestation program, literally planting a little over 3 million trees is what we're planning for. And so for us, I mean, through active management, we will recover the Douglas complex damage on our lands. We'll convert that vaporized 6-year-old stand that we had so much time and effort in on the left-hand side back to a vigorously growing forest that is going to produce products down the line for the company. But it's encouraging, and we have a great relationship with Mike and his team. But for us, we're still very concerned about what we see and what's happening out in the recovery of the lands. And our big question continues to be what will happen on the BLM lands. We agree with Mike that that safety, especially along the roads and access hazard tree reduction, will occur. We're absolutely confident in there. But from there, we see a diverging pathway, especially in the late successional reserve areas. Because these lands are currently in the NEPA process and their land use allocations, the guidelines and standards that the district managers have to follow, their hands are really tied. It's going to be limited action within those areas, and we see that as a real transfer of risk to leave areas in snag patches and brush fields and not in timberland again really changes the risk profile from our perspective, and from a fire management point of view really puts our lands at risk and our investment. And these discussions aren't new to Mike and myself. We have them constantly every time we get together, but just to kind of show a couple of pictures of what I'm thinking. We agree we'll make our roads safe. These are Douglas fir timberlands. Those are big, tall trees. If we don't provide for safety and hazard tree reduction along our roadways, we know what the future will be. They'll eventually come down and clog access and provide safety issues for our crews and our workers. But where we're diverging and where we're concerned about is safety, especially in the LSR areas. The idea of that of adjacency is relatively new out there. But I'm concerned about putting my crew up against that property line with that big timber that's going to fall down and degrade over time. We really need to find ways to address that, and the only way that we can think of to do that is through active management. And here's a great picture I'm showing on the left. Here's a black and dead forest. That is the Douglas Complex as it currently sits today. Those large snags on the skyline are in LSR. I'm really fearful that there will be any action in those areas. They will present a fuel load and a receptor to another dry lightning storm down the line. We know that in our area it's not if, it's going to be when, and that's a huge concern of ours. The track record here is not good, I'm sorry. Here's a picture on the right-hand side of the Timbered Rock fire of 2002 and BLM LSR. Very little, if any, salvage was accomplished on that fire, but still the same timber type that we see on the Douglas fire or complex. So 10 years later, the Timbered Rock LSR in the areas of 100% mortality is snags and brush fields. I'm really fearful of how that's going to turn out on the Douglas Complex. So we'll continue to have discussions. We'll continue to be engaged. But really, without engaging in a larger discussion of reform, of policy, after catastrophic wildfire events like the Douglas, it'll be really interesting to see where we get. So that's my presentation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bencher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple, so can I? Okay. You know, Doug, I really appreciate, you know, that your outfit and what they did this summer and the long hours, and I think you had a pretty good safety record within your outfit this year, and you had everybody working lots of hours. So, and I also appreciate how fast you're jumping on the reforestation. You got the plan lined out. You know, you're going to have a timber sale. You know, you're only dealing with 400 acres, but you know, the private sector, the logs are going down the roads right now as we speak from the private lands. In fact, probably some of them are already 2x4s being put up in somebody's house. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I really appreciate that. You know, Phil, I know your company, other timber companies during the fires were out there helping, doing what you can. And I know going through your mind, you're going, you were already engaged. How am I going to repair this when the fires are still burning? I know it. I know people like you. And Mr. Haskey, you know, your outfit really hasn't done much. And I know you know better because you are a forester. And you started out working on the ground. And I know you know better. But your hands are tied just like a lot of the people. And there's some fantastic people that work for your outfit. In fact, 20 years ago, if I did make the statement, I should have. It was one of the best outfits I ever seen manage public lands. But now, it's pitiful. Literally pitiful. When you were giving your presentation, my stomach was churning. You keep talking about safety. If you want safety, then those snags and those dead trees along the roadways should already be on their way to the mill. Because every day when your folks go out there and driving past them, that's safety. So, you know, you keep talking about safety. You don't think the private sector worries about safety or ODF worries about safety? We all worry about safety. You know, I've been working men in the woods all my life, and safety is number one. And if you ever get me really spooled up, it's when somebody puts somebody else in an unsafe place out there. But nothing's going to happen. You have Dexa logs, green logs, have been sitting there for 3 months from this fire. And I know you can do a 30-day sale advertisement, and they're not. And so now you're going to delay. We're going to have some weather move in. And the next thing you know, we won't move those logs out of those decks until probably late next spring. So we're going to have lost value. The pine's probably going to be gone. And it's the same thing. And I already know how this is going to play out. ODF's going to have their stuff done. The private sector is going to be over here getting their stuff done, and they're worried to death that you're not going to do anything on yours. You're going to grow brush, and they're going to have another fire, and it's going to go wipe out all the money that they just did in reforestation. And I'd like to bring attention to everybody is all those fires on that map that Mr. Decker showed all drain into the Rogue River drainage. So all of that stuff is going into one drainage. But you guys aren't doing nothing. And it's not a direct attack to you, because I know you know better, and I know you're just as frustrated as the people I talk to in your offices. They are just pulling their hair out in frustration. But you need to take that back, and I need to take that back, and we need to take that back. And we got to start telling people we got to do business different. We still have to worry about wildlife habitat and stream protection and all that, but we can still go in the private sector and move through this in a fairly rapid rate and address the same issues. And I know you guys aren't going to do it. You're not going to do the salvage. You're going to do a little roadside salvage. You're going to sell those green log decks, and that's going to be about it. And I think everybody that's in the business knows that. And we got to start changing that. And I hope that you can be one of those people that start.
Well, Senator, I can certainly understand your frustration. You're right. We do get frustrated with process. We are trying to take a different approach this time than we have in the past. Phil mentioned the Timbered Rock fire. I was back in Washington, D.C. when that fire had burned, but that was in the area I worked in when I worked in Medford. And we did put up a rather, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but we had a pretty robust timber sale, post-fire salvage plan for that sale. And it was litigated, and we lost. And I don't remember all the court history because I was back in D.C., but that was we did have quite a robust reforestation project there. I mentioned the controversy around post-fire activity and our litigation history. That was one of the cases that I had in mind. I hope that I can disagree with you and come back next fall and say that we have done a lot.
I hope so, too.
That is certainly our intent. Will it be across every acre that was within the fire boundary that Doug showed on his map? No. But where it's appropriate, especially on those matrix lands, I hope I can come back next fall or next winter and say, here's what we have done, and we have put a lot of wood and logs on trucks, and we've done it in an environmentally responsible way, given the land use allocations and direction that we have to work under.
And that's the frustrations I'm talking about. I mean, you have to do NEPA. I'm thinking to myself, why would you have to do NEPA on something that's newt? There's nothing there anymore. There's no wildlife, there's no vegetation, there's no trees, but yet we're going to have to study all this stuff, you know. And as we're studying this for so many months, and that's what I'm saying is policy change. And please, this is not a direct attack at you or the people work. There's some fantastic, I know, you know, I've been working with your outfit for almost as long as you've been in it, okay? And you've got some great folks out there, but they're frustrated, and I know you're frustrated. And we have to, you know, you have came up through the ranks. And you have to start pounding on that drum, too, along with us. Okay? We got to start doing the right thing. Okay? We have really taken some steps backwards. And we got to straighten that out. And I hope we can do that together.
Do we study the effects of these fires on the watersheds over time? So, I mean, I assume the rogue's going to get dirtier for a while because I don't know how, and all of them, even if you reforest quickly, you're still going to have some problems because where those got really burned, that stuff's just laying there ready for the first rain. So do we do that study?
We have in place a long-term monitoring program called the Aquatic I'm used to acronyms, AREMP, the Aquatic Resource Effectiveness Monitoring Program. And it's interagency with the Forest Service and the BLM. So we do long-term watershed trend monitoring, yes.
Because I think from my perspective, that's what's important to have a conversation with my friends in the environmental community about the effects of these things if you don't take care of them. Because you will see that drainage coming off there in larger amounts than you would necessarily have to have if you did the replant and some of those stuff in some of those sensitive lands. And I think overall the danger to our environment can be stretched out longer because we don't do some things than if we did otherwise. And I would like to help everybody understand that a little bit better because I think we've lost sight of that. That's why management does help. It's not to change the forest makeup. It's not to do all those other things. It's to help nature rebound and make it a healthier environment quicker. And I think sometimes our friends get really uptight about that. They think that nature is nature, so it's best just to leave it alone. You didn't get there naturally. We've done too many things in between. So that's just me. And I really appreciate all of you coming and talking because I think we do have to continue to have these conversations and work together in ways that we maybe haven't in the past. And I agree. We have a commitment to share with our federal delegations the same information. So,
like I always say, Arnie, having a heart attack is natural too, but we do something about it.
That's true. Any other questions for this group? I really do appreciate it. I will say the last year or so since I've been the chair, our ability to get the federal people and these different bills to come and be a part of our conversations has really been heartening. I mean, it's really a positive from my perspective. So I thank you for being here and forestry and our private sector people who the checkerboard is a big issue, and I wish we could figure out how to deal with that in a different way, in ways that I know the federal government's having a hard time doing that too, but if we could get patches of it traded out so we didn't have that kind of management, we might be able to see other better advantages over time as well, where you have private ownership in larger blocks and whatever. And then you can see the differences as opposed to having them imposed on each other. It would be really impressive.
Mr. Chair, as we talked before we started the formal part of it's not a hearing,
right,
informational session, and as I noted in my opening remarks, this is a new forum for me, and I would very much like to participate more and being invited more, and
okay.
I have all sorts of processes even there that I have to work through to come and talk to you folks. But I think it's an important dialogue. The ONC lands are important to all of us Oregonians, and there are a lot of issues out there, and there's a lot of activity going. You know, we've started our land use planning process. That's what we have under our control. We all know that there's House passed legislation and potential Senate legislation to be introduced.
Yep.
So there's a lot of dialogue around these lands because they are so important to all of us. And I look forward to informing and dialoguing and providing information whenever I can in whatever form I need to.
I appreciate that very much. And I agree. I've worked with BLM people for the 32 years I was at the high school in Coos Bay. And they're exceptional people who really understand the business. Mm-hmm. They've been doing it their whole lives. So they care. And we want to make sure that all of these different interests can be maintained in appropriate ways. And that's, I think, the hope of all of us. Any other questions? Well, thank you all for being here. And we're going to close our informational meeting on the post-wildfire management. And we will invite you back. And hopefully you'll get to look at Senator Barrett Sugar in the face and say, look, we got all those logs out of there.
I'm hoping.
And the last piece of business we need to talk about is any ideas that you guys might have. I'm going to list. We have four concepts right now that I've had conversations about with the idea of committee bills. None of them, only one of them have we actually started working towards, I think. But one was a wave energy one that had to do with changing the identification of wave buoys as being under the same conditions that hydro dams are, because that's the only hydro we have, and so they're all considered the same, and they don't make sense. The governor is putting together a group to work on that, so I don't think we need to do that. I think we'll wait and see how that happens later. There's a trail, what's the name of it?
Salmonberry.
The Salmonberry Trail issue that the State Parks is working on, and Betsy Johnson asked me to think about that one. I am concerned. That's the one we've actually started having some conversations with Legislative Assembly on, and I'll get more information on that one later to you. The other one is the RV fees that came up last time, the last session. It has to do with splitting the fees between state parks and county parks. I am waiting to hear, because there is a committee going right now at the governor's office to work that out, and if they need our bill, I would like to use it for that, if that's okay with people.
Senator Johnson.
Yeah, we've all had that conversation, and I think they're moving forward. My understanding is they kind of have an agreement again that we could go to that 65-55 or 45-55, and they have some underlying principles of that. If we can get that in a bill, we'll use this one if they don't have another one. The other one is a resolution on ONC, depending on if our senator comes up with something. I'm meeting with him this next weekend on Sunday. If we think we need something there, that's another one. So we have three. If there are other ideas, I know you had an idea, which was about...
It's a jobs bill.
A jobs bill, and it was about...
giving the counties money to pay part of a training wage. They would have a grant at some point to pay $2 of a training wage for youth 14 to 19 years old
to work in some of these other fields. And so instead of, because of the cost of the minimum wage, it's that training wage. And I am one of those people who believes we need to get kids out working.
Me too.
And this really can be helpful. And so if we can come up with a grant. So we're still in that discussion about that
idea. Lynn County is actually doing this, a very small scale.
Then I have one, and it should be out of LC, and what that, and it's kind of an emergency one because it's reforestation on these lands that got burned over, and there's no salvage.
Did you use your...
No, don't I have a half of one in the committee?
Yes, you do. That's what I'm saying. That's what we're talking about. Yeah.
And
so we have to agree on one, so that's the other one.
And in fact, I'm going to talk to you in the next couple of days about it.
That's what I was hoping. So those are the ones. And anybody else have any other ideas? We have three, so we will work out which of these get to that priority, and then we have our own personal two goals.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what's getting ready to happen, but all the cameras are coming in at the end of our meeting. So
it must be for next session.
I'm assuming someone's coming in.
Yeah.
Not us.
So it's another committee. So with that, I'm going to say we will work and get those bills out and let people know when we get that done. And for now, we will adjourn our Rural Communities and Economic Development. Thank you. Economic Development. Thank you.